This is Crossings Radio. I'm Jonathan Bach.
He drove out to the winery where he had found out that both of them worked, and the winery gates were locked. And he drove back to town and called up the family because he found out what their phone number was. And he said, "Look, I hate to bother you, but I would like to interview you. I went out to the winery, but the gate was locked," and there was a long pause. And Mr. Dietz said, "I'll do an interview with you because you're the only reporter who hasn't broken down the gate or jumped the fence and trespassed." So that's how he got the interview, was by being a decent human being.
Welcome back to Crossings Radio. This is part two of our discussion about the shooting at Umpqua Community College in Roseburg, Oregon. Crossings co-director Peter Laufer talks with the journalist who covered Roseburg. If you haven't listened to the first half of this discussion, you can find it on our website at unesco.uoregon.edu. I highly recommend you listen to that episode first. In this second part, we're going to look at the aftershocks of the mass shooting in Oregon where a gunman shot and killed 10 people, including himself. Today we'll answer, what's it like for community members to have reporters inundate their town? How long should national media cover a story before handing the whole thing over to local outlets? Should it be a day? Should it be a week? Let's listen first to Charlie Dietz. He's a doctoral candidate here at the School of Journalism and Communications in the University of Oregon. Charlie wrote his master's thesis on the 2012 shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School. He starts his thesis with this line, quote, "The news coverage of the Newtown, Connecticut shooting brought to the fore some of the profession's most glaring deficits." Dr. Peter Laufer asks, "Were there any differences between Roseburg and Newtown?"
It's hard to tell because it was so fast-breaking. That's a good point. Yeah, my thesis was looking at the reportage of Newtown, but comparing it with Roseburg, it's a hard acrobatic thing to do, but I would say I saw more similarities than differences, I guess, the way I was seeing it happen. It tends to become an environment where it's prone to rumors, and those I think can be the most damaging to our profession and to communications in general, where you really don't have anybody running the ship and nobody fact-checking, where, you know, reporters who don't have a lot of direction are trying to source things out. I know in Newtown, there were so many people doing stand-ups that reporters were pulling rumors off of other reporters and trying to source them on the fly over the phone as they were about to go hot. I'm not sure if that wasn't happening, but the way it appeared, the way that the live coverage appeared, it looked like people were pulling rumors off of one another. And that's a danger that we should be thinking about, is where we're getting our information from. And you could see it on CNN while they're doing their live coverage, just basically taking phone calls, hearing a rumor, and then asking some sort of, you know, ancillary witness if they believe that rumor to be true, things like that. So the sourcing was questionable, and that, I think, happened. So I wouldn't say there's lessons learned yet. A lot of it has to do with, you know, maybe not a lot of people have protocol for this yet. Unfortunately, they should at this point.
Now here's Rebecca Force, a journalism professor here at the University of Oregon and a former TV news assignment editor. Peter asks her, given what we know about the shootings, what can reporters do to prepare?
At its lowest common denominator, this is probably the most sensitive possible assignment anyone could ever receive. Day one coverage of hideous events is event coverage. It's what happened. It's the who, what, when, where. It's very infrequently, are you going to be able to answer the questions of how and why? And for people to be put on the spot and ask, how did this happen? Why did this happen? Is putting them in an impossible situation, and if you report on what their answers are, you're likely to be wrong. So the first day is going to be an OMG moment. You know, horror has once again struck. And who are you going to send? And do they have the decency to behave well with people who are in dire straits? We were fortunate enough to have a guest speaker visit our class who was covering the shootings at UCC for CBS. And he was a graduate of our program. His name's John Goodwin. And he ended up getting two absolutely amazing interviews with the family of Kim Dietz. And I may be pronouncing her name wrong. But the way he got them was by being decent. He drove out to the winery where he had found out that both of them worked, and the winery gates were locked. And he drove back to town and called up the family because he found out what their phone number was. And he said, look, I hate to bother you, but I would like to interview you. I went out to the winery, but the gate was locked, and there was a long pause. And Mr. Dietz said, I'll do an interview with you because you're the only reporter who hasn't broken down the gate or jumped the fence and trespassed. So that's how he got the interview, was by being a decent human being. And I think that there's room for that in situations like this, and I think that there's room for being able to, as Cam Schultz, the young man who's taking photographs here tonight, was telling me when he was down there also shooting, that he was walking in and people were going, leave me alone. And he said, no problem. No problem. There just isn't a need to put a camera in someone's face and to step all over their souls.
Unfortunately, our job was to be the eyes and ears of the community. As a photojournalist, I don't have to ask questions, thank goodness. But we still have to be part of the historical record, which is what Sun was talking about.
That's Dan Morrison, a professor and war photographer. He's worked in some pretty gritty locales, from El Salvador to Afghanistan. Dan went down to Roseburg with Cameron Schultz, a student photographer at the School of Journalism and Communication.
You also want to be enormously respectful of the people. I will say, and Cameron even asked, what were we looking for? What you try to do in a situation like that is you want to humanize this. One of the interesting things about all of this, we can all now rattle off. I think it has been a very long time since we've gone more than something like 10 days without a shooting on a campus. It's been months. There was a shooting this morning at Tennessee State. A student was killed. We're not even talking about that. It has now become just, oh, yeah, there's another shooting today. So one of the things you want to do is you want to humanize this. These are, they're not statistics, and in some ways they're not students. These are human beings. These are loved ones, and you want to humanize that as much as you can. So Cameron and I, we talked about it. I said, unfortunately, you're going to have to take a picture of somebody in a very emotional state, unfortunately. They will be crying, and there'll be a lot of hugging and probably some praying. We have to get it. We have to let people know these are human beings that are being shot and killed. But I will also say, and I told Cameron, I said, we are not going to get in anybody's face who does not want to be photographed. You have to be incredibly sensitive to the fact these people are going through probably the worst moment of their life, and yet you have to get the historical record, and you have to humanize it, in my opinion.
And now the audience has questions.
Hi, Kelly Knoyer. I'm an SOJC student as well. I just wanted to also get your guys' opinion on whether it's ethical to name the shooter and why you would name the shooter or not.
In a flash, name the shooter. I don't think that there's a question about it. This is a person who has committed an amazing crime. And if society doesn't have an interest in figuring out who that is and why they did it and what their background is, there's something really wrong. We cannot ignore that. And I, you know, the stats are generally that people do not remember the names of most of the shooters. So I don't think it's going to do much harm, but it's really okay for the community to know the name of the fox that's in the has been in the hen house.
I think Anderson Cooper tried it twice at Newtown and in Tucson to not name the shooter until he was, you know, basically pressured by outside media. It was already out there, so there's no point in not naming it. It usually comes across as a symbolic gesture. You know, you're going to broadcast and publish the entire act and then try to leave like a blank spot for the name. Like, you already have the act out there. You know, it's completely symbolic at that point. Now, like, there's this sort of media studies concept called the copycat effect that's been applied in newspapers to suicides. Generally, newspapers don't report suicides because they found that the more they report it, the more it happens. I mean, you could take issue with the method, but that might be kind of where they're trying to take that from. Like, don't give glory to that person or something like that. But in my opinion, in my experience, by the time you've already documented the act for 24 hours, not putting the name on the top is like giving a gift without a ribbon. Like, it's still right there, right? So symbolic and stupid, I agree with.
I agree as well. I'm a little bit surprised, quite frankly, that there was any discussion of that whatsoever. You are, as a professional journalist, you're trying to provide an accurate historical record. It's not like journalism was invented 2 days before this event happened. You know, in a very emotionally charged situation, which of course a shooting like that would be, you know, people will say, do this, don't do that. Well, look, we've been covering events that are horrific for years and years and years. And we know what happens when emotions calm down and time has passed and people start thinking what, in retrospect, what is the right thing to do? I mean, those of us in the J school, you know, the AP style book is sort of our Bible. You know, this stuff is not new, unfortunately. But the idea that in the heat of a very emotionally charged situation that you should listen, especially in this case, if I'll get in trouble here, especially a sheriff who seems to have an agenda of his own as well, it's like, I don't think you want to go down that road. There are well-established guidelines for situations like this. And those guidelines have been formulated over years and years and decades of very, very professional people who've dealt with similar situations, and they're out there. I'm surprised there was any discussion of that at all.
And it's perhaps an important footnote to point out that the sheriff has a different job than a journalist. And part of the sheriff's job is to provide a public record. So although the sheriff announced that he would not himself name the shooter, the public record of the sheriff's department includes the name of the shooter.
I'm Jonathan Bach. I'm a research fellow with the Crossings Institute. And this is
here, I'm asking Charlie, what kind of effect can a massive media inundation have on a town like Roseburg? And why is it important for journalists to make that first draft a history? You're going to hear the phrase packed journalism thrown around a lot here for the next few minutes. That refers to when a swarm of reporters descend upon a situation and overwhelm the locals.
My specialty is obviously Newtown, and the residents there had witnessed their city become a city of reporters. And a lot of people had actually left Newtown to stay with family outside of Newtown because of the pilgrimage of not just people showing their support. You know, there were a lot of people coming from across the country to show their support for the Newtownians. But there's a pilgrimage of journalists. People couldn't go to the grocery store to get milk without having seven cameras in their face. You know, and the issue I take in my thesis and you know what I advocate for is that it's not the reporting of it that becomes a problem. It's the scale of the reporting. It's the same story being told 1,000 times. We kind of had these institutional demands that, you know, journalism, it's kind of like a Wild West, right? Everybody gets to go. It's the public right to know. Everybody gets to be there. But at some point, it does seem to be like just journalists working off of other journalists in the community is like almost inert at that point. So I take a somewhat skeptical view of the impact that journalists have in that scale. But again, that's solely my opinion, and other people who have experienced it more firsthand may have a completely different experience of it.
I think that there is such a thing as packed journalism. Most of the time when there have been huge stories that were covered, most of the journalists thought they were there as individuals, but the story was so large that it drew huge numbers of journalists. There are times in which bad journalists report what other journalists have picked up. So it's sort of pick it up. Everyone reports the latest tweets or social media or Facebook that they found, and they find it on one site, and they just keep on doing it. So that does exist on occasion. But Japan sent a news crew to Roseburg. There were trucks from all over, and it is because the issue is so huge. The unfortunate result of it is that you get seven cameras in your face. But I don't think that you can say that all the that there were simply too many journalists there. There were, but not as individual journalists. So people pick up their publication and they want the story that their publication has reported. In a case like this, most of us are going to read every publication we can get our hands on, trying to triangulate and find out what other people know and what was the truth, and can you triangulate that way and sort of hone in on what was really happening, because there were so many unanswered questions. So it's, you know, I decry packed journalism, but I consider packed journalism at its worst to be ganging up on people and reporting things that have already been reported by other people.
And before we get the next question, would either or both of you, from the standpoint of photographers, like to weigh in?
Yeah, hand me that stack of newspapers real quick, sir. Be my assistant there. This is not to push back on that, but I had a really wonderful conversation with a colleague of mine, Mark Blaine, about this when he got back. Not to push back on what Rebecca said, I think when it's a breaking news event, it is almost impossible to avoid the packed journalism situation. I think after that, it's almost irresponsible to be part of the PAC journalism. The following day, when you're trying to figure out what happened, what really happened, I would argue you don't really get anything from that news, that photo, that you don't get from that photo, that you don't get from that photo, that you don't get from that photo.
Dan here is holding up the Register Guard. It's a newspaper based here in Eugene, where the University of Oregon is, and the Oregonian, our state paper. The same photo is printed on the cover of both papers. Two women crying and embracing.
Now, those are all Andy Nelson's photos, but also because Ryan King is a really terrific photojournalist, he was shooting for AP, and I don't know, how many, what's your last count, how many clients that you're aware of published? It's global. Well, it's absolutely global.
Some of these are
Andy. Those are all Andy Nelson, sorry.
No, some of those are Andy.
Are they really? Well, there you go. There you go. There's the
So just to jump in here, that's Ryan Kang sitting next to Dan. Ryan is a UO student and also a photographer contracted with the Associated Press. So his photos ended up all over the world.
All these newspapers did not send photographers, and that, and my point is that's good. They got Ryan, who is shooting for AP. You know you're going to use an image exactly like that. Everybody is trying to get that picture because that's the picture that's some, that's the reason it's a global image. Because that image, I was there. If you were going to say, find the one image that's going to sum up, there it is. As a photojournalist with any experience, you know exactly when you see that, that's the shot you have to have. Everybody takes it, so to speak.
So I'm wondering what you all have to say about how ethical it is for the amount of time that you spend covering an issue, and especially, Charlie, as you've seen how things played out in Newtown, how long do you think it is ethical to stay with the story there, both to do it justice, but then also to give people their space and let them go back to their lives and let them have their town back?
That's Molly. She's a Crossings Institute research fellow, too.
Another tough one we could spend a lot of time on, but how ethical? I mean, there's numerous ethical frameworks you could apply, but the people who work for the Newtown Bee are still there. And occasionally, unfortunately, it still comes up. You know, so I think it depends on if you're a parachuter or how close you are to it as a journalist and you know, how invested you are in that community as journalists should be. How many reporters who were at Newtown a few years ago call up their sources that they talked to when it happened? How's everything going? You know, I mean, is that part of the reporting? Are you forming a relationship with these people, or are they really just subjects for a story? I mean, that it's hard to answer, I would say. I think that, you know, a lot of times the standard is about a week that there's a camp of reporters, and then they sort of trickle out and they take their planes and buses home. But, you know, there's community members that are journalists that are still there. And they watch the rebuild. You can look at the Newtown Bee even today, and there's probably still residue of the rebuild. And that's going to be going on for quite some time. So how ethical is tough, but I see what you're getting at. And again, it's really hard to know because although these are mass shootings, they're all very different in different communities and different settings. So I would hate to make a non-answer my answer, but it's tough to jump in on that one. Good question, though. Wonderful question.
There's a cycle that happens. You talk about formats and formulas for covering things like this. There will be a one-year anniversary, and people will cover it. And there will be a five-year anniversary, and people will cover it. And the video that was shot will be shown again and again and again. And it will be over time. And so for the people who are in that community, the ghosts are going to keep on being raised over and over and over. As far as the immediate coverage of it, it's sort of a how long is a rope, as long as it needs to be.
Here we hear Melinda Benton, the journalism faculty advisor at Umpqua Community College in Roseburg.
I wanted to speak to part of Molly's question. In Roseburg, we do not have very many restaurants, and we really don't have very many that serve a certain kind of food that you have arranged that's healthy. So McMenamin's is one of the few restaurants, and it's the place where almost all of us as faculty hang out. And McMenamin's, unfortunately, was also where a lot of the reporters were hanging out. We had not met them, but a lot of us sat there and we could pick them out of the crowd. To let you know how different Roseburg is a little bit from going to school in LA, in one of my classes, I always ask students to raise their hands if they've ever been to the coast, which is an hour and a half from Roseburg, and seen someone from Roseburg. Every class for 10 years I've asked that question has between a third and a half of the students that raise their hands. Okay, so we're that small and that interconnected, so you don't have to wear a name tag. You know, someone in the group is going to know that you're from outside. And McMiniman's was the place that offered the teachers from Snyder Hall a room to meet, which I am one of them, and talk. And so losing McMiniman's was kind of really hard.
This is Crossings Radio, a production of the University of Oregon UNESCO Crossings Institute for Conflict-Sensitive Reporting and Intercultural Dialogue. For more information on the Crossings Institute, visit unesco.uoregon.edu.